Today's Wednesday, August 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, First Lady Melania Trump makes the case for Donald Trump's re-election on the second night of the Republican National Convention Tuesday.
Melania Trump on Tuesday night, as well as Tiffany and Eric Trump.
Renewed calls for change and racial justice following another shooting of an unarmed black man. Also ahead, a major hurricane heading toward the U.S. Gulf Coast could bring mass destruction.
Sometime during the day on Wednesday, we are now forecasting it to become a major hurricane, Category 3.
It's all on today's International Edition. The people closest to President Donald Trump, his family, were the stars of the second night of the Republican National Convention Tuesday as the GOP works to reintroduce the president to American voters in the midst of the campaign and a pandemic. As on the night before, Trump himself played a significant role in the primetime programming. Joining us now for highlights of the second night is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara. Patsy, it definitely was a family affair.
You're absolutely right. On Monday night, the first night of the convention, we heard Donald Trump Jr. trying to convince the American people why his father, Donald Trump, deserves a second term. And on Tuesday night, we heard First Lady Melania Trump speaking about some of the more softer side of the president, reflecting some of her favorite moments as First Lady, and trying to make a good case to the American people about why it's so important that her husband continue as president for the next 4 years, as well as laying out some of the things that she wants to do with her own initiatives, particularly with the initiative called Be Best that has to do with child wellness in the next 4 years. So it is interesting to note that nearly one-third of the 2020 RNC speakers are either Trump's family members or people who worked for him, including his family, immediate family, Melania Trump on Tuesday night, as well as Tiffany and Eric Trump. Now, this, of course, comes with the background of a couple of negative controversies, if you will, coming out of the Trump family, the Trump extended family, a recent book by Mary Trump called How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, as well as a leaked recording of his sister, Marianne Trump, also calling him dangerous for the country.
We also have another controversy in one of the speakers from Tuesday. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo gave a taped address to the convention from Jerusalem.
That's right. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's decision to address the RNC in this pre-tape remark from Jerusalem, you know, what a backdrop. It really does break with past president of secretaries of state not addressing political conventions, and also a longstanding protocol of not discussing domestic politics while abroad, not being overly political, not being involved in a campaign. And it really has drawn a lot of scrutiny and scorn from diplomats, particularly because months earlier, Pompeo reminded employees not to improperly engage in the political process, not to engage the Department of State in the political process. Mike Pompeo's decision to do this from Jerusalem is, of course, to highlight the Trump administration's Pompeo's address from Jerusalem is, of course, designed to highlight the Trump administration's recent announcement of normalization between United Arab Emirates and Israel. Now, UAE is, of course, the third Arab recognized and normalized relations with Israel. And so the Trump administration considers this a big win. A State Department spokesperson defended the move by saying that Pompeo would deliver the remarks in his personal capacity and that no taxpayer funds will be used. But still, the optics of it creates a lot of controversy here in the U.S.
There have been more groups of Republicans this past week popping up, announcing they're voting for Joe Biden. The Trump campaign so far has been trying to portray Joe Biden, trying to give dire warnings that electing Joe Biden would be horrible for the nation. It's unusual, too, that why haven't we seen any of the former Republican presidents speaking on Donald Trump's behalf?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, normally a Republican presidential nominee would see top Republican figures, including former presidents, you know, lining up to speak, endorsing them, supporting them at the Republican National Convention. That's not the case for Trump, who is really not considered the standard bearer of the Republican Party. For example, President George W. Bush will not be featured at the RNC, even though a Bush family member has spoken at every convention, 1980 to 2012. But President Bush in 2016, including H.W. Bush, also sat out the 2016 RNC when Trump received the party's nomination. And in 2020, Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida and 2016 presidential candidate, will also not speak. Also absent are people like the Cheneys, another big name in American politics. So yeah, this is really interesting. It really does showcase the fact that Donald Trump and the Republican Party in many ways are quite far apart. This is now RNC 2020 is the Trump 2020 convention and not so much the traditional standard bearers, old guards of the Republican Party.
VOA White House correspondent Patsy Weedakuswara, thanks so much. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has declared a state of emergency and sent members of the Wisconsin National Guard to the town of Kenosha following violent protests after the shooting of a black man by police. AP reporter Ed Donahue has the latest.
Family attorney Benjamin Crump says Jacob Blake is paralyzed and it would take a miracle for him to walk again. He says there's no justification for the shooting.
There was deliberate indifference.
Pat Ordle's store in Kenosha was ransacked.
This is not justice that they're looking for. This is destroying things.
Jacob Blake's mother is telling protesters to stop.
If Jacob knew what was going on as far as that goes, the violence and the destruction, he would be very unpleased.
The officers involved are on administrative leave. The Wisconsin Department of Justice is investigating. I'm Ed Donahue.
More than 500,000 people have been ordered to flee the U.S. Gulf Coast as Laura strengthens into a hurricane that forecasters say could slam Texas and Louisiana with ferocious winds, heavy flooding, and the power to push seawater miles inland. Eric Blake is with the National Hurricane Center. He says the areas where Laura is expected to make landfall today or early Thursday could see dangerous storm surge.
We're forecasting 7 to 11 feet above ground level is possible in portions of southwestern Louisiana to extreme eastern Texas, with lesser amounts on either side.
Laura passed Cuba after killing nearly 24 people on the island of Hispaniola, where it knocked out power and caused intense flooding. Officials in the U.S. are urging people to stay with relatives or in hotel rooms to avoid spreading the coronavirus. The coronavirus pandemic is the third major crisis to hit the Middle East in a decade, following the tumult of the 2011 Arab Spring uprisings and the start of the oil price declines in 2014. And regional analysts suggest the health emergency has lessons that can help in bringing fundamental change to the region. They say innovation, both in the Middle East's economies, in particular for Gulf Arabs who've been relying heavily on oil exports and educational systems, is needed to confront new challenges as the world moves into more renewable energy sources and is increasingly tech-driven. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Speaking with the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, former Jordanian Foreign Minister Marwan Muasher says Arab governments used authoritarianism to skillfully tackle the coronavirus pandemic. However, they should not apply the same to socioeconomic challenges facing their countries.
We need to move from rentier economies to productive economies, from patronage to productivity. It's easier said than done, but the oil era in the Arab world is over. Both oil importing countries and oil exporting countries need a different model of economic activity.
Analyst Dania Kolilat of the American University of Beirut's Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy argues that shale oil and renewables are pushing down the price and utility of oil. Writing in the Saudi Daily Arab News, she says oil majors like Saudi Arabia do not have the luxury of moving gradually from a rentier economy based on oil wealth to a productive modern economy. Saudi Arabia needs to achieve in one generation what other nations like China have achieved in three, and that's why innovation is key, she says. Saudi Arabia has relied heavily on oil revenues for some 87% of its budget. Plans to diversify its revenue streams, however, have been hampered by COVID-19. Still, the U.S.-Saudi Arabian Business Council reports that the kingdom's renewable energy projects could create up to 750,000 jobs while providing 7% of its electricity output by 2030. as one positive development. Meanwhile, the United Arab Emirates is moving ahead to develop trade, green economy, and food security, as well as finance, energy, and health sectors, incorporating technological innovations and digitization. UAE Vice President and ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, says it aims to be the fastest recovered economy in the world from the COVID-19 crisis. Moasha agrees that education that engenders critical thinking and innovation must be adopted quickly for the Arab world to move ahead.
We need to move from rote learning to preparing citizens. Our educational systems just do not prepare citizens to deal with the complexities of life. I'm not even talking about preparing them for the marketplace. COVID-19 is one such complexity. It's not going to be the only such complexity in the future.
Khalilat says Saudi Arabia must also generate and groom enough workers to take on new jobs as the kingdom transforms. Experts suggest artificial intelligence-based learning technologies can overcome current educational challenges and upgrade employee skills for the future. Dale Gathlack for VOA News, Amman.
An ECOWAS delegation has left Mali without an agreement with the military junta on how long it will run the country before a transition back to civilian rule. The West African group is meeting again to discuss the situation following last week's coup. International Edition Steve Miller spoke with Bagasi Kura of VOA's Bambara service about the latest developments.
They had three days meeting led by former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. They spent 3 days in Bamako discussing with military leaders who have done the coup against former President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. During the negotiation, it has been reported that on the first day, the coup leader have proposed 3 years military-led transition, a transitional government that should be overwhelmingly composed by military elements. And that offer, when it was leaked on Sunday, was not well received within the public, and the military came out strongly saying that they never say so. But yesterday it appeared when they went back again for the last day of negotiation, they proposed 2 years transitional period with still a military head of state. And the ECOWAS has reportedly proposed 7 to 12 month transition period led by a civilian. So there has not been an agreement, and Goodluck Jonathan decided to leave Bamako and to go see the head of state, who are meeting tomorrow. The 15 head of state of ECOWAS have a virtual conference this Wednesday on the situation, and those are the ones who will decide what to do, if they should go ahead with the sanction which have been put in place, or if they will come up with a new idea how to move forward. But what we know is that the junta during the negotiation has agreed to free President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. They say he is free to go home. He's free to go overseas for medical care. And they say because they've done that, they want ECOWAS to lift the sanctions.
One of the things that came out during this meeting is that former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan was able to meet with President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, who said that he wasn't forced to resign, but also that he didn't want to become reinstated as the president. So I guess the question I have for you is, given that the junta was looking for a 3-year transition to civilian rule and ECOWAS was looking for a 7 to 12 month transition, what are the people in Mali saying that they want?
I think people are more in line with ECOWAS transition, but there is no clear line. I know there are still a couple of people who want military-led, because the opinion in many countries in Africa are always in favor of strong men. So you have those people who are advocating for a military-led, because they say the country is very corrupt. We need somebody strong to be able to clean up the house. But the majority of the people are saying, no, that's not the route we need to go. We need to give a transition to civilian, and it need to be shorter so that we, the country, can go back to normalcy.
That was Bagasi Kora of VOA's Bambara service speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. The Trump administration says China is buying corn, soybeans, pork, and beef from the United States that they promised they would under phase one of a trade deal. But there are no expectations in Washington for further progress in any negotiations before November's election. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has details.
Officials in Beijing are taking a wait-and-see approach, hoping they can strike a better trade deal with a new U.S. president next year. That's the assessment of President Donald Trump's top assistant on trade policy, Peter Navarro.
The Chinese Communist Party wants Joe Biden to get elected. They have no interest in negotiating anything more until Election Day.
Earlier Tuesday, U.S. and Chinese trade envoys had a telephone discussion, but there was no subsequent announcement about ending the tariff war between the two biggest global economies. Steve Herman, VOA News at the White House.
An independent report into Australia's black summer bushfires has recommended sweeping changes to land clearing practices and the creation of an international research center to investigate extreme fire behavior. The 2019-2020 disaster was unprecedented in scale. The Gospers Mountain Fire north of Sydney was the largest forest fire ever recorded in Australia, burning more than 500,000 hectares. Phil Mercer reports for VOA from Sydney.
More aggressive hazard reduction or controlled burn-offs that can reduce the severity of future bushfires would make Australia safer, according to an independent panel. However, previous research has shown that as conditions get hotter and drier, it becomes less effective. But the report wants landowners in high-risk areas to increase prescribed burning. It also said that climate change was one of many factors that made last summer so extraordinary. The fires were fueled by record-breaking temperatures and a long drought across southern and eastern Australia. New South Wales State Premier Gladys Berejiklian says global warming is making the country more vulnerable.
The next fire season is already upon us. So the government has taken every action we can already in response to the recommendations that we received. We do have to also accept that in addition to the issues that have been canvassed this morning, our climate is changing. And those who wrote the report actually acknowledge that our climate is changing.
The New South Wales State Government has accepted each of the panel's 76 recommendations. The report has called for more scientific research into fighting fires, including the use of artificial intelligence and drones to help put them out quickly. It said the answer wasn't more fire trucks or firefighters. Critics of the inquiry have reportedly said it was lackluster and contained no significant recommendations. The Black Summer fires killed more than 30 people and destroyed thousands of homes. For the first time ever, catastrophic fire conditions had been forecast for Australia's biggest city, Sydney. Ominously, the panel warned that Australia should expect to see similar conditions or worse to happen again. For VOA News, Phil Mercer, Sydney.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The Kremlin said on Tuesday it sees no need to investigate circumstances leading up to opposition politician Alexei Navalny's grave illness and that a German clinic's initial diagnosis of poisoning has not yet been conclusive. Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday called for an investigation and for Russia to hold the perpetrators accountable. Two leaders of the opposition in Belarus appeared in court Tuesday after a night in jail as the government continues to pursue a crackdown on the few figures still at large. More mass demonstrations are planned against President Alexander Lukashenko, even with most major opposition figures being jailed or in exile. Lukashenko has failed so far to stop protests against his 26-year rule, more than 2 weeks after an election his opponents say was rigged. And Jerry Falwell Jr., a major force in the U.S. evangelical Christian movement, whose endorsement played a key role in President Trump's 2016 victory, has resigned as president of Liberty University. Falwell's departure as head of one of the world's largest Christian universities came a day after reports that a business partner of the Falwell family alleged that he'd been in a years-long sexual relationship involving Falwell's wife and the evangelical leader. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Pride Afrique is the first of its kind, a three-day virtual extravaganza celebrating Africa's diverse, colorful community of sexual minorities. But behind the glitz and glam, participants say is a very serious need to bring gay Africans into the light as their lives are threatened on the continent every single day. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Homosexuality is illegal in more than half of Africa's 54 countries, with penalties ranging from jail time to execution. Even in countries where same-sex relationships and fluid gender identities are decriminalized, they remain culturally unpopular and often result in discrimination or even targeted violence. And as if things weren't challenging enough, the coronavirus pandemic has eliminated the ordinary daily social encounters that can break down stereotypes and foster understanding. And so, thought a small group of queer African filmmakers, writers, and artists, in these socially distant times, why not bring queer pride to everyone? That was the purpose of this year's inaugural Unusual Pride Afrique Festival. The multimedia celebration of Africa's rainbow of sexual minorities was held virtually over 3 days this month, amid restrictions across the continent that prohibit large gatherings. About 1,000 people tuned in digitally on YouTube. Festival committee member Welcome Lashiva says that while the event may look fun, sexy, and glamorous, its underlying message is very serious.
72 countries in the world criminalize homosexuality, and 32 of them are in Africa. So it is very important to have initiatives like Pride Afrique, where queer people in Africa can come together to reclaim their power, to reclaim their voice, and to reclaim their pride. Reports still show that queer people are still living difficult lives in relation to everyone else, even in South Africa.
Lashiva brought up several recent examples, including a continuing epidemic of violence against lesbians and trans women in South Africa, which was the first African country to decriminalize homosexuality. Over 3 days, dozens of participants shared their experiences of coming to terms with their gender and sexuality. Those accounts were important to festival participant Noni Salma, who spoke to VOA via Google Hangouts from her home in New York. Salma, a filmmaker, says attitudes in her native Nigeria keep her from feeling comfortable there. She is transgender, and her work has explored themes of homosexuality in Africa.
I think it's important to see African
queer people being joyful, because I think it's revolutionary. I think it's as important as, you know, highlighting our trauma and our pain. I think that that's magic. And I don't want to discount what that could do for queer people in Africa who are struggling and who do not see that, who do, you know, who don't even know that that's a thing. 14-year-old, 12-year-old me would have loved to see that, you know, that yes, pain exists, but also joy is something that also that we can have.
Professor Jean Nel, a psychologist and researcher at the University of South Africa, says visibility is the first step towards acceptance. Nell studies violence against sexual minorities and is lobbying South Africa's government for a new bill that will track and classify such incidents as hate crimes. He recalled South Africa's first known pride parade in 1990, before homosexuality was decriminalized. The 100 or so participants wore brown bags over their heads to conceal their identities out of fear of retribution. That's why, he says, there's so much power in unmasking and celebrating queer Africans. He says many problems stem from the notion, which he and other academics and historians dispute, that homosexuality is un-African.
In an African context, a lot of the pushback, if you want to call it, would be based on outdated colonial laws, a tendency to scapegoat during political conflicts, perhaps a religiosity that is quite evident in much of Africa. We have religious, well, rigid beliefs in cultural and family values. And then, of course, a very strong patriarchal mindset. And I would say all of those things would feed into why some people would indeed say being LGBTI is un-African.
Lashiva agrees, but added that this year's festival gave him something he badly needed in these lonely, socially distant times.
It really suddenly feels like I have a new family, and my personhood, my dignity, and my rage against homophobia, transphobia, and biphobia has been affirmed by Pride Afrique, because I know there are people out there like me. I know there are people out there like me who are beautiful, who are powerful, who have, you know, powerful thoughts about making the world a better place.
That's what matters, he says, to be proud, safe, happy, and accepted at home in Africa. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg. Listening for the
best. And finally today, a budding young mathematician says she has been overwhelmed that pop star Taylor Swift donated £23,000 toward her university tuition. 18-year-old Vitória Mario, who moved from Portugal to the UK 4 years ago, harbored dreams of studying math at university but discovered she wasn't eligible to receive maintenance loans or grants despite landing top grades. Swift's generosity comes as her most recent album, Folklore, is number one on the Billboard 200 albums chart for the fourth week in a row. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.
Is it chill that you're in my head? 'Cause I know that it's delicate.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week, right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on the Voice of America.